call our T-Mobile home internet.
Warning, the following podcast features views and opinions that are not representative of the collective views of the Whispers group. Some of these views may not be suitable for children. Accordingly, the producers and hosts of the Missy AE podcast must insist that no one attempt to take anything that is being said as representative of the views of any of the Whispers groups.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the Missy AE podcast. Tonight, we bring to you Sports Whispers Weekly, where we talk nothing but sports for the duration of the show. For those of you who are expecting a podcast last Friday night, we apologize for not being able to bring it to you because Blog Talk Radio randomly decided, you know what, we're just going to shut down our servers for the entire week. So, unfortunately, we weren't able to bring Sports Whispers Weekly to you guys last week. However, we are back this week, and I mean that just means more stuff to talk about. We're gonna dive into the March Madness finals that took place this past week. We will discuss the beginning of the Major League Baseball regular season, as well as take a look at the playoffs in the NBA, which are set to get underway later this week, as well as a preview into the Stanley Cup playoffs as well. Right now, we have Lou and we have Diane on the line. How are you two doing tonight?
Hi, Steven. I've been back, but on the second question.
Well, I'll say it's definitely great to be back after a week of Blog Talk mishaps, we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And I want to start off tonight's show with a little recap of WrestleMania 40. For those who don't know, WrestleMania 40 was a two-night event that took place at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, this past weekend. And the key attraction for this past week was, would Cody Rhodes finish his story? Would he finally do what his father could not do and officially capture a world heavyweight title? Luckily, his father is Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, who is no longer with us, unfortunately. He's been dead for a couple of years now, but basically Dusty Rhodes. He was a former NWA champion, and he also originally he had won the WWF championship, but due to what they call the Dusty Finish, all of a sudden he had the title taken away from him. Which essentially, usually what happens is either there's some sort of disqualification or something where somebody knocks into the referee, and while he originally wins the title, the referee who was knocked out then gets up and reverses the decision and changes it to a disqualification. And that's exactly what happened in Dusty Rhodes' case.
Yeah.
So the story for the last two years has been about Cody Rhodes attempting to finish the story in the WWE ever since his return to the WWE to do the one thing that his father couldn't do, which was win a world championship. And
wow.
Ultimately, this comes at the expense of Roman Reigns, who was in a record-breaking, I think it was 1,316-day title reign, which obviously is the longest title reign that they've had since Hulk Hogan, all the way back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
I've heard Hulk Hogan.
Who hasn't?
Yeah, well, I mean, Hogan. You know, Hogan's one of the one of the top names. Well, he's one of the top names in all of wrestling history, though. So, you know, when you look at title reigns, there's Bob Backlund, Bruno Sammartino, Hulk Hogan, and Roman Reigns is the fourth longest title reign in wrestling history for a world title. So, obviously, night one, the main event was Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins taking on the Bloodline, which consisted of The Rock and Roman Reigns. And basically, the stipulation was if Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins were to win, then there would be no Bloodline members allowed to interfere in night two's main event. However, if night two came around, or if the Bloodline were to win, which they ended up winning, then the stipulation would be that it would be a Bloodline rules match, which is basically anything goes, essentially. And ultimately, that's what ended up happening. The Bloodline, The Rock and Roman Reigns, ended up defeating Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins by pinfall on night one to set up night two's Bloodline rules match. In, if anybody has seen the Avengers movies, and Avengers Endgame was the most recent one that they did, this was basically the Avengers Endgame WWE version, where all the bad guys band together and all the good guys band together, and they all go at each other. I mean, we saw cameos from, or we saw run-ins, I should say, from Jimmy Uso, who then got taken out by his brother Jey Uso by diving off of the stage into the tables below. Then out came Solo Sikoa, did a couple of Samoan spikes to Cody Rhodes. Everybody thought that it was going to be a repeat of last year and that Cody Rhodes would lose once again because of Solo Sikoa. Cody kicks out at two. Out comes John Cena. He gives an attitude adjustment to Solo Sikoa and then puts him through a table on the outside. So that takes out Solo Sikoa. Then The Rock comes out, lays out John Cena, And everybody here is expecting, okay, now Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to come out, right? Because him and The Rock have history together. Instead, the bell tolls and The Undertaker appears in the middle of the ring. Undertaker, of course, also has history with The Rock as well, but everybody was expecting Stone Cold. Stone Cold chokeslams The Rock, and this basically lays the groundwork for Cody Rhodes to land three consecutive crossroad finishers for the 1, 2, 3. Cody Rhodes wins the undisputed WWE Universal Championship from Roman Reigns, snapping Roman Reigns' record streak of 1,316 days, and thus officially finishing the story in what some people are calling one of the greatest WrestleManias of all time. Some other matches that we saw, in particular, title changes. Earlier on in night two, Drew McIntyre defeated Seth Rollins by pinfall to take the World Heavyweight Championship. However, due to outside interference by CM Punk, Damian Priest capitalized on this and cashed in his Money in the Bank contract, defeating Drew McIntyre to become the new World Heavyweight Champion. Logan Paul, he defended his United States Championship successfully by defeating both Kevin Owens and Randy Orton by pinfall. Bayley captured her, I believe, fourth Women's Championship by defeating Io Sky, her former alliance member of Damage Control. And then on the previous night, you want to talk about breaking records, Sami Zayn ended Gunther's record-breaking Intercontinental Championship reign of 666 days by pinfall. Sami Zayn is your new Intercontinental Champion. Rhea Ripley, she successfully defended her Women's World Championship, defeating Becky Lynch in the opening match of Night 1. And we have new tag team champions as A-Town Down Under, being Austin Theory and Grayson Waller. They successfully captured the SmackDown Tag Team Championships, and The Awesome Truth, comprised of The Miz and R-Truth, officially captured the Raw Tag Team Championships, thus officially splitting up the Undisputed Tag Team Championships. So, needless to say, and also might I add, they had quite a number of people, a combined total of 145,298 people between both nights attended this year's WrestleMania in what is considered to be, I believe, bigger than last year's total. I may have to double-check that. But as far as the other matches go, LA Knight defeated AJ Styles by pinfall. The Pride defeated the Final Testament by pinfall in a Philadelphia street fight, where ECW legend Bubba Ray Dudley was the special guest referee. Jade Cargill saw her WrestleMania debut and WWE debut, quite frankly, as a success, as her, Bianca Belair, and Naomi defeated Damage Control. Rey Mysterio and Andrade defeated Santos Escobar and Dirty Dominic Mysterio. And Jey Uso defeated his brother, Jimmy Uso, by pinfall as well. So, needless to say, obviously, you know, this was what we were going to cover last Friday night before Blog Talk decided, yeah, we're not going to do that. We're just gonna decide not to work for you the entire week.
You know what, so, for you.
Yeah. Well, so
Blog Talk has been having problems.
They have been having problems. Matter of fact, last week we weren't able to do our Survivor show, our Survivor recap show that we do every Thursday night. We weren't able to do it last week because of it. That's what kind of made me wonder if maybe we may not be able to do last Friday night's show, which we ended up, of course, not being able to do.
Well, I wasn't able to call in anyway because I wouldn't be home.
Right, well, I mean, but regardless, though, you know, regardless, I was planning on doing a show on Friday night before Blog Talk Radio basically decided, I'm not just going to not work for you guys, I'm not going to work for anybody on Blog Talk Radio, so.
No, we'll say baby on that one.
Yeah. But next we move on from WrestleMania and we go over to March Madness with the UConn Huskies. The UConn Huskies repeating for the first time since, I believe, 2006-2007 when the Florida Gators did it as national champions with a 75-60 victory over Purdue. And I know what everybody's thinking. Everybody's thinking, you know, how could Purdue lose by double digits when they were considered to be UConn's toughest test? And I'll say the same thing that I said on your show earlier, Lou. Depth. UConn had the depth. Purdue relied on Zach Edey.
You can't rely on one player.
That's right. You can't rely on just one player. You can have players try and double team that player, but with Edey, you know, Edey's an animal. And, you know, putting up a double-double with 37 points and 10 rebounds. I believe one of the killers for Purdue was the fact that they only attempted 7 3-pointers, and they only landed one out of those 7.
Well, you're not going that.
You're not going to be winning. You're not going to be winning a championship by attempting only 7 3-point shots.
No.
Especially in this era of basketball as well. Let me bring in Alex and get his thoughts on this. Alex, what are your thoughts on Purdue ultimately falling short of UConn?
Yeah, hey guys, thanks for having me on, Steve. I think it was just like you said. UConn has the numbers, they have the depth, they have the bodies, and it's so tough to win it all with one guy. And, hey, UConn, Edey's a heck of a player, 7'5", but, I mean, UConn's got a good answer for him. Klingon, probably a better pro. He's faster, more athletic guy. And he's a lot shorter. No, he's not. He's 7'2". So he's another giant. So it's like they kind of like – Edey probably outplayed him. Edey was also getting the ball force-fed to him every single time down the floor. They were pass to Edey. Like you said, they didn't really attempt threes. UConn can score from all different angles, all over the floor. And Purdue was like, Edey, Edey, Edey. And that's just not going to work against a great deep team like the Huskies.
No.
It's not going to work against any team.
No. It's,
right. It's not going to work not just against the Huskies, but also not really against any team when you think about it. Because, I mean, there's – when – it's one thing when you have one player, like one bona fide star, it's like, okay, now you're going to have teams try and double team that star. And, you know, it's different with Edey, though, because Edey, you know, all he does is basically go to the basket and that's it. But yet, here you have UConn who made 6 3-pointers out of all their starters, And not just that, but they also got some contributions off of the bench as well. They had 13 bench points, 13 bench points compared to 2 on Purdue.
I mean, if you combine the two like teams, if you like say you're doing like a draft, let's see who like the best players were. I mean, Edie's the best player on the court that night. But then, I mean, in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, it might mostly, if not all, be UConn players if you really look at the players, because you got like 3 or 4 UConn players that are going to be in the NBA. I mean, they just had more depth. I saw role players for Purdue play a lot better. Like you said, no one else helped them really at all. So they did kind of they almost didn't really play up to their expectations. They didn't help their cause. They could have played a little bit better, Purdue, I thought.
Right. Yeah, they definitely could have. It doesn't help Purdue the fact that they had two players, or that they were playing against two players who, quite honestly, could potentially go in the top 5 in this draft, with Donovan Clayton and Stephon Castle.
Castle's more raw. Yeah, looking at him, though, he's, like, more raw. He's a role player. Like, UConn, like, Spencer Carabin, Tristan Newton. I mean, Castle probably has the ball, like, the fourth most. He doesn't even take that many shots. And this shows how talented they are. I mean, Castle, if he was on Purdue, he'd probably score 20 points a game. But on UConn, he's just, like, almost a role player. Like, they spread the ball out, so they're so tough to defend because anyone can beat you by scoring. You know, Purdue, it's like you got to just look at Edie, and then UConn spread out all over the floor. Anyone on the court can beat you.
Right. But, you know, in particular, when it comes to UConn, I mean, obviously, you know, all mock drafts are different. But the one consistent thing I'm seeing is that UConn, both Castle and Klingon, are easy first-round picks. The only difference is where will they fall in the first round? Will they be top 5, as some are putting them, or will they be in the middle of the first round, as some mock drafts have been putting them there as well? But I think it just goes to show you the fact that that UConn is just so much deeper of a team that they can rely on anybody on that team to put up meaningful minutes, as opposed to Purdue, who really, it's like all they have, they need somebody other than Edie to put on a show. And nobody really showed up for Purdue other than Edie.
Yeah, I read something interesting after the championship with, like, Hurley, and he, you know, plenty of people don't like him. He's definitely very cocky. I got to admit that. Like, they're my favorite team, but, like, he could say some pretty, like, you know, we've been running the country hoops in America for the last 30 years. He said something really quite ridiculous. Like, up on the podium, he thinks he's God's gift to basketball. So he is full of himself, but, I mean, they are awesome. Hurley's the coach of the Huskies.
Yes.
Okay.
But he was saying something interesting. He said when they recruit people, because 2 years in a row, I mean, they don't really have that star power. I know they have two top picks coming up, but, like, they didn't have anyone close to as good as Edie. So he said they'll turn down plenty of people that are 5-star recruits that are more like ego and, like, just want to score and, like, ball hunt. He said they don't even recruit people like that the past several years. They recruit people who play defense, who, like, pass the ball a lot, who will be just as happy taking 4 shots versus, like, scoring 30 points. And he also sits up at the interest. He also makes sure he meets the parents of all the players in person and to see, like, if they really, like, stay on their kid as far as grades. You know, who knows how much is true. He's making it sound like they're, like, the golden child of college basketball now. But it is pretty interesting. Like, I guess they just look for, like, really good defense, and they don't just kind of hire maybe, like, you know, if you look at a team like Kentucky, they'll always have these one-year guys that are, like, you know, doing 360 dunks. But how much are they really caring about winning the championship before they go to the NBA? UConn is trying to get guys that really want to be in college. UConn, they want to be in college. Sounds corny, but it's true. That's what they're looking for now. It's a dying breed. Like, it's not like it used to be. But, like, these kids are, like, kind of throwback, like, blue collar, and they'll play defense, and they just want to win a championship. Pretty cool. It's unique now.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to score. Everyone wants to score, and they're looking for kind of old-school players.
Yeah, I mean, that, honestly, that's definitely, you know, that's the type of, you may want to attract five-star recruits because, you know, it makes your university attractive. It's kind of like free agency in sports, where the more attractive names that you attract, the more likely you'll get other well-known stars, or in this case in college, other five-star recruits to eventually join your system. And from what we've seen with UConn, it's clearly worked the last couple of years. You know, these last 2 years, it's clearly worked despite all the losses of players that they've had. They've been able with this system to just to have a next man up mentality, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, Klingon was a freshman last year. So he wasn't even starting, and now, but at least now he's leaving. He put in 2 years. Castle's kind of the exception. He's a freshman and he's leaving, and he's like the rawest guy they have. He shot like 4 or 5 times in the
national championship.
Any team taking him in the lottery in the NBA, any team taking him in the lottery is betting on his future potential. So like they've won it with a lot of upperclassmen. Whereas if you look at a team like Kentucky, I keep harping on them because they're like what's been wrong. Where they were just recruiting guys for 1 year, go straight to the pros. 1 year, go straight to the pros. And you're not going to win with all freshmen. You're not going to do that. Hopefully Calipari, I know Jim, and I root for the Razorbacks. Hopefully, that one and done, it's not going to win championships when you're just relying on all freshmen. I don't think it would.
Right. Believe it or not, despite how despite how touted Zach Edey has been, he's not even projected to go in the first round in this draft.
He's projected to be
a second round draft pick, like a borderline first. Like when I say borderline, I'm talking like the last couple of picks in the first or the first couple of picks in the second. That's what he is currently projected right now.
It's so big. The NBA is so different now. There's no like even Patrick Ewing or guys like that anymore. Everyone who's in the NBA, you got to shoot threes, and you're guarding guys out on the perimeter. It's totally different. So there's really no like he'll get exposed. He can get abused on defense. They'll pick on him. He won't be able to cover his guy in the pros. That's what the concern is. It's just such a different game now in the NBA.
And not just that, but they're actually suggesting that teams avoid any bigs, especially in the first round. And when I say bigs, I mean like 7'2", 7'3". Teams are actually being suggested to avoid those type of players from now on until the second round. And with Edey, of course, being 7'3", Edey is 7'4". With him being 7'4", that makes it even worse.
I think he's 7'5", Steve. He's bigger than he's an inch tall, or he's the same height as Wemby. But Wemby's 5 times faster than him. That's the problem. Edie's, I really like Edey. He seems like a good kid too, but he's slow. He's slow. We got to call a spade a spade. He's a good player. He's a giant, but he's slow. And it's like, like the NBA, they want everyone to be able to move fast and shoot from all over. It's totally different than it used to be even 10 years ago.
What are your thoughts, Lou, on first off, what are your thoughts on UConn taking March Madness over Purdue. But also, what are your thoughts on how certain prospects are looked at, like, now in when it comes to potential drafting?
Yeah, well, I had UConn to win, so I was right about that. But I didn't think it was going to be, you know, the kind of game it was. I expected a lot closer, especially after Purdue made it a game in the first half. But UConn has more depth than Purdue. Purdue only relied on Zach E., and that's not how you win games. You can't rely on just one player. I mean, everybody else, you know, to back them up. UConn has several players, and, you know, they made more threes. UConn, like you said, was 1% from the three-point line, and you're not going to win if you miss all that from the three-point line, because UConn will, or any opponent will come back and pull up a lead and won't be able to fight back. So that's how you lost it right then and there. Well, what from a competitive game looked like a turn to a runaway in the second half. I expected better. And the way they recruit these days, you know, it's a lot different than what we did. I mean, now they got these deals, NIL, and everything, and sponsors. You know, is there really such a thing as amateur anymore? I mean, you know, you get signed, you know, to a school, through scholarship or whatever. But we never had to deal with these endorsement deals before. You know, the Heisman Trophy made somebody famous, but we didn't have to deal with these endorsement deals from shoe companies or Gatorades and whatnot. So it's a completely different ballgame now on how they recruit these players. You know, it's more like they're semi-pro than they're just amateur players who the first priority was to get an education in the first place and not become superstars.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, it almost seems like players nowadays all want to become superstars and want to show off for the draft, as opposed to actually wanting to focus on winning a national title, it seems.
Which takes defense, passing, the little things, not the flashy Sports Center dunk of the night. Yeah, that's where the kids are now. They want to do that on TikTok. They want to see us jamming it and shooting three, you know, got to do the dirty work. So I know there's other teams out there. It's not like UConn's going to just be running away every year. Definitely not. But Hurley was kind of acting like they were the only team, but doing it. But they are smart. Like, more teams got to do that. You should want to get players that are going to stay on campus for more than a year. You know, you should want to get players like you said, Steve, and Lou. Like, the players that are just, they want to look good on TV and score 40 points, and they're already thinking about where they're getting drafted, you know, in their first semester in college. If you're built up in the lineup like that, you're not going to beat an older, less selfish roster like UConn's. UConn's just different than that.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely, I think if anything, we're really being shown just exactly how, you know, how teams manage recruitment and everything differently when you consider, you know, normally when you think of March Madness, you know, you think of the big universities like Duke or North Carolina or Kentucky, which, by the way, had a little interesting tidbit on Kentucky in just a little bit. You don't think of the other universities like UConn or, like UConn or Purdue or, you don't think of any of those smaller, it's funny I say smaller when you consider that UConn, what title is that now for them? Six?
Yeah, I believe, six. But no, I hear what you're saying, Steve. You think Carolina. Carolina, definitely Kentucky. You think of different programs first as being, like, the most badass program.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of Kentucky, John Calipari is now the new head coach of the Arkansas Razorbacks.
Arkansas.
And it's very interesting that this happens because Kentucky heading into this up or into next college season, had the number two ranked, the number two ranked recruitment class. Now, there's talk that after Calipari has left to join Arkansas, that some of those players from that recruitment class may be following him.
Nice.
To Arkansas. And, you know, it's funny that we think about the, you know, Kentucky and Calipari. Calipari, you know, has been one of the top coaches in all of college basketball for God knows how many years. I mean, he has a combined record of 855 wins and 263 losses at the collegiate level.
Wow.
And, I mean, this guy is a six-time SEC champion. He won March Madness in 2012. You know, he's had six trips to the Final Four, although two of them were vacated, I believe, if I recall correctly, for multiple reasons. But, I mean, you know, this guy has been a champion basically everywhere he's went. And not to mention a three-time college coach of the year as well.
Yeah, if I committed to Kentucky, I'd be looking right away. It's like a big reason why would be because of Coach Calipari. So, yeah, I'm looking at Arkansas right now. I'm getting back in my bag, researching our transfer. Let's mom, dad, you know, I'm going to Arkansas. I wouldn't blame any of the transfers, any of the recruits, if they want to switch it up and follow their coach. He's a major reason why they would want to go to Kentucky. If he's now in Arkansas, you're going to Arkansas.
Yeah. And it's funny that this is brought up because the main reason why he is now in Arkansas is because Eric Musselman moved from Arkansas to USC because he wanted to go back home and coach for USC. And Musselman was well known in Arkansas for his recruitment techniques and being able to bring over quite a few stars over to Arkansas when it comes to recruitment. Mm-hmm. So for Eric Musselman leaving to join USC, you know, it left a whole bunch of different questions as to who was Arkansas going to. Who were they going to bring in? You know, I'll tell you one thing, and this is from speaking with Jim, who of course is a Arkansas alumnus. John Calipari was not on that list.
No.
There was literally no talk whatsoever that Calipari was on the outs in Kentucky. And the reason being, the main reason why he left is the fans forced him out.
The fans basically wanted him out?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the boosters are the ones who talk in college sports. Mm-hmm. You know, if the boosters threaten to withhold their funding, you know, they can threaten to withhold their funding, and thus, you know, the college ends up losing a whole lot of money. And now, because of this, the big reason why that kind of helped move Calipari over to Arkansas was the guy that owns Tyson, you know, the Tyson chicken.
Yes.
The guy who owns the Tyson company is the big mover behind this move.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about, like one of probably the biggest booster out of all the boosters that they have,
for the show.
They put forward the money. It was basically, my understanding was, it was basically they gave him a blank check, tell him to give him what, to ask him whatever he wants to come to Arkansas.
Wow.
And so they officially signed John Calipari to a 5-year, $40 million contract. That's $8 million per year that he'll be making on this deal. And also, not just that, though, he will get $6 million per year in NIL money. So for people who don't know what that is, that basically has to do with your likeness and everything, merchandising and whatnot. So he's going to get an additional $6 million per year based on that alone. So that comes with incentives. With incentives, he'll be making about $15.5 million.
Tell him all about the music thing. And I have thought about it all
15,
tonight. That I'm going to stump
so
you with.
$15.5 million per year.
Don't take away the music. All right.
I mean, let's just start with you, Lou.
Mute
it if there's noise.
Yes.
Lou, let's just start with you on this one. What are your thoughts on
Calipari? I had to be in 75 or 77.
Huh? Oh, I think we lost Lou. Well, let me go to Alex then. Alex, what are your thoughts on Calipari leaving Kentucky to sign with the Arkansas Razorbacks?
Yeah, he was getting looked down upon and talked poorly of. Not really. I don't think it was his fault. He kind of projected that sudden image recently where he was like, he embraced the idea of, oh, yeah, if you want to come get a year under your belt and go right to the NBA, you can come to Kentucky. And it kind of backfired on him. He's a lot better than that. He's an absolute legendary coach. So when the tides turned and the fan base, you know, they weren't going back to the Final Four like they've always been through the years, yeah, they got salty about it. He didn't deserve to get shown the door, but he was getting kind of, you know, mistreated, kind of pissed on, stepped on. So he didn't need that. He's better than that. He said, okay, you know what? And then it's this great university like Arkansas, who has a good tradition overall in athletics. You know, they're definitely a good program and a very good school. They have a lot of money to offer. Calipari doesn't need Kentucky, and I can start over there. He's going to have plenty of money. He's going to have great resources. We saw Musselman have some really great teams. They have some good NBA players, Anthony Black, Nick Smith, the many, many others, but I'm just talking like in recent
Bobby
memory.
Portis.
So Bobby Portis, of course. Yeah, I'm leaving a lot of names out. But, yeah, they're obviously no stranger to recruiting top talent, and Calipari is as good as anyone of landing five-star thoroughbred recruits. So it could be a match made in heaven. And it's a new start for him. You know, he doesn't need to suffer or, you know, try to prove himself anymore. If Kentucky turns on him, hit the road and start somewhere new. And that's what he's about to do. They can easily go to the Final Four the next 2 or 3 years, you know, right away. He's got to hopefully,
right.
I'm thinking, yeah, one or two of those top recruits will follow him. You know, it can't happen overnight. If they don't, if those Kentucky guys, you know, it might take 1 year. You know, but then, I mean, they could have, like, they could have a top class as soon as, you know, within a year, they could have a Final Four team right away. It's a huge move. It's a huge landing, you know, huge addition for Arkansas, for Razorback Nation.
Yeah, but let me just bring down a list of players who have left for the NBA under John Calipari in Kentucky. Bam Adebayo, Devin Booker, Anthony Davis,
wow.
De'Aaron Fox,
yeah.
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Tyler Hero. We'll skip that one. Tyrese Maxey, Malik Monk,
yep.
Jamal Murray, Emmanuel Quickley, Julius Randle, Shaedon Sharpe, Carl Anthony Towns.
It's a much deeper list than UConn. Much deeper. But they kind of look those guys, though. But the problem was, though, Steve, they got so caught up in that. Like, some of those guys would have been even better, and Kentucky and Calipari's squads would have been much better if those guys all didn't say, oh, well, Booker did it. Anthony Davis did it. So I'll leave after 1 year. Imagine if, like, Shai Gilgeous stayed 3 years. He would have developed for Kentucky and been the superstar on campus instead of for the Thunder. So it's like,
right.
You know, all these guys were so good, but the best versions of themselves, the NBA teams got. Calipari didn't get to coach them when they were truly hitting their prime. By the time they were growing up and learning how to play really, really top-level ball, they were getting drafted into the lottery. They were leaving Kentucky. So it's like, he obviously doesn't want to keep doing that now that he's in Arkansas. You know, you want those kids around for 2 years, most of them, or 3 years.
Right.
It's just that one and done can be so dangerous, you know what I mean? Even Duke doesn't. Duke still has people that will go one and done. But, I mean, I'm not knocking Calipari. I think that's what kind of, like, limited his success in the long run with Kentucky was that a lot of people, maybe the players just got carried away. They, like, expected to just go there and play 1 year and leave. And Calipari kind of,
right.
like, allowed it. He kind of went with it.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, now they have Mark Pope as their new head coach out there in Kentucky. So I don't know how things are going to change with Kentucky under Pope as opposed to Calipari. I'll tell you one thing, though. I think you're probably going to see a drop-off when it comes to recruits. Considering that, I mean, come on. I would rather play under Calipari, who has so much experience. I don't want to compare him to Bill Belichick, but, I mean, come on. The guy's been around for I'll compare him to Coach K. You know, if Coach K was still coaching.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I would rather play for Coach K before I would play for another coach in particular.
Absolutely. You'll see that we'll all see the recruits. The list of recruits that'll come in Arkansas are going to be top of the line right away. I mean, he knows how to recruit, which is everything in college sports, football, baseball, basketball. I mean, yeah, he's a recruiting guru. So, I mean, Arkansas they landed a gem there.
Right. We've added Lou back. Lou, I want to get your thoughts on John Calipari to Arkansas.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a bad move, but you know, Kentucky is where, you know, he became the legend and whatnot, and they go to Arkansas, you know, but Kentucky, I think, is the rule of the SEC, and, you know, I just aren't worrying how it's going to transfer over, is it going to be a transfer of success to Arkansas? You know, he built up a legacy in Kentucky, and Arkansas is not what Arkansas is more football than basketball, in my opinion. But I think he can get the program a jolt. But at Kentucky, he will surely be missed.
Yeah, you know, when you were off the air, Lou, we were Alex and I were discussing this, and it's entirely possible that you could see a mass exodus of Kentucky recruits follow Calipari to Arkansas.
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
And the reason being, you know, Kentucky going into this upcoming into this next season, they had the number two ranked draft class. For recruiting. And now all of a sudden, ever since Calipari was announced as moving over to Arkansas, they've had a couple of players decommit. So it's definitely and when it comes to Calipari, it's definitely a game changer, I feel, for him going to Arkansas Because I mean, Arkansas, you know, they had a couple of big recruitment classes under Eric Musselman, but I mean, Musselman is one thing, Calipari is another.
Exactly. You can't compare Musselman to Calipari.
I mean, Musselman had a few players under him go to the NBA, but I mean, Calipari, you know, I just named a whole entire list earlier of players that he's coached to get to the NBA. So, I mean, it's just at this point, I believe that, especially with the price that they're paying for Calipari, you know, he's going to be making, with incentives, around $15.5 million per year. So it's definitely something that to keep an eye on, because you know how we discussed odds earlier on your show, Lou.
Yes.
How we discussed odds of winning the national title. If I were any bettors, I would take a look at what Arkansas is right now.
Yeah.
And
so, I mean, gotta give it a year. You gotta pump the brakes a little bit. You can't build Rome in a day.
No.
I mean, if they're not gonna suddenly all show up on campus and beat UConn in 2 years.
No.
2 years,
no. I'm not saying that, Alex. What I'm saying is right now the price on Arkansas is plus 3,000.
Wow, okay.
And
now you're talking. I apologize, Steve. I apologize. That's crazy. That's worth it.
And that was before the signing of Calipari. Now I don't know if it's changed since then, but the price was plus 3,000. For Arkansas.
Wow. I'll look it up real quick. No doubt. It's going to be a huge change now. I just feel like they're going right away. Hey, if like three or four of those top recruits go with him, who knows? They could win it all. Who knows? If those recruits are as good as they sound like. While you're doing your thing, Steve, I'll look up the odds too in the background.
Because the number one thing that he said... Yeah. In his press conference was that he was going to return Arkansas to being more of a team-based system, being more for the team, like how UConn did it these last 2 years. With Arkansas, their players were focused more on themselves as opposed to doing what was best for the team.
Exactly. When did he get when do you get named the coach? Because I'm looking at, like, some random Vegas article that's all about betting. It's saying plus 4,000. So if you put down...
Oh, wow.
Geez,
okay.
That's huge.
So plus 4... Oh, okay. So it actually went... It actually got even worse than what I had read. What I had read, it was plus 3,000.
No.
Dude, if you put down 100 bucks... And the Razorbacks won it all, $100, $400,000, almost $500,000. Jeez.
I mean, I'm not saying that they're going to win it all, but you know, I'll tell you one thing. Like we said earlier, I'd rather have Calipari as a replacement than have anybody else with Musselman leaving.
Absolutely. I was just trying to say, Steve, it'll be tough to happen right away. But if they bring in the top recruits, they could be a top five, top seven, top eight team right away. And I'm saying in 2 years, when he really has time and he's on campus and then really recruiting for a full year, then, I mean, you might see them make the championship game in year two or win it all.
It's
and they
possible,
can still be
yeah.
awesome next year. So I know. I think the impact is going to be huge. It's just he's got to start getting those guys transferred. And then, you know, after a full year, though, he's going to have – I would say definitely they should have the best recruiting class maybe in the country in you know, in like a year from now. He's going to recruit
right,
a lot of that
program. I'll tell you one thing too. He's not going to have a problem with fan support out in Arkansas. He's not going to have a problem with that whatsoever. So,
yeah.
You know, you're not going to be seeing fans trying to get him out of Arkansas like Kentucky did. Now, Sam Pittman, on the other hand, for football, Sam Pittman is a completely different story. But that's for another day. I mean, Arkansas is kind of doing the same thing to Sam Pittman right now. But that's basically because their players have basically they've essentially stopped performing, we'll put it that way. Going over to the NFL, one of the big things that... Huh? Must have been something in the background. Going over to the NFL, one of the big things that we were going to, that I was going to discuss last week before we ended up not having a show, the Buffalo Bills, they decided to continue their fire sale, trading Stephon Diggs to the Houston Texans in exchange for a 2025 second round draft pick. Houston also receives a fifth and sixth round draft pick to go along with Stephon Diggs in this trade. So now you have the Houston Texans, who have a stud young quarterback, and now you add Stephon Diggs to Tank Dell and Nico Collins. I mean, I'll tell you this right now. I think we've seen the end of Buffalo's contending in the NFL, in the NFL in general.
Which is crazy. I know everyone can say it about several teams, but I've always thought, dude, Buffalo, I mean, you got to be realistic. We're not 5 years old, right? When I look at different teams in any sport, I'm not just saying, oh, it's Eagles. Everyone else sucks. They're going to beat everyone. No, that's something a five-year-old does. So for years, I've been looking at, wow, the Bills are awesome. Like, they've been so close for, like, what, 4 years? And now they didn't even make it to the Super Bowl. I've always thought they were so good. They had everything. And then it's like this year they got really injured. And then, like you said, Steve, they've totally pulled the plug. Like, they've gotten rid of, like, half their best players at least, if not most of their best players. Ugh.
And now they get rid of Stephon Diggs. And the biggest thing about this, though, Alex, is he wasn't even on his own. He wasn't worth a second-round draft pick, apparently.
Yeah, they just – he commented. It's crazy. I guess there's a lot more to it. Like, he seems like he's a little, like, a head case. They were just sick of him being a diva, like most Big Ten name wide receivers. But you can't just dump the guy off for almost nothing. You're right, Steve. They should have gotten a lot more for him.
Yeah, but they had to give up. The thing that's crazy about this is they had to give up a fifth and sixth round pick in order to get him.
Wow.
For a sec. They had to give up a fifth and sixth round pick along with him in order to get it up to a second round pick.
Ugh. Yeah, and they lost Gabe Davis too, and they lost like two-thirds of their defense. They lost their starting center. Yeah, Josh Allen's going to get, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, hopefully not, but it's like his whole supporting cast is gone.
I mean, 8 touchdowns this year, 11 last year, 10 the year before. How the hell is this guy not worth a first-round pick?
Crazy. I'm surprised. I mean, Dallas jumped in. His brother's in Dallas. They could have gotten him. Second round pick. Yeah.
How the hell is he not worth a first?
Yeah, you're right. Crazy. I guess with their salary cap, man, they were just looking to really just dump money. They're just trying to get rid of people.
Right. Lou, what are your thoughts on this, Lou? The fact that Stephon Diggs, by himself, isn't even worth a second-round pick. They had to give up a fifth and sixth-round pick as well in order to get him for a sec, or in order to get a second-round pick for him.
There's logic in that. Why would you do that? You know, I'm thinking, that doesn't make a lot. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Everybody's folding out. I just don't. I have to guess. I mean, some of these trades are just not, you know, kind of weird. But I mean, it's a whole different ballgame nowadays, Steve. You know, kind of how many black players and whatnot at the colleges. It's not like when I was young.
I mean, honestly, it's just insane looking at this. Just looking at this trade and thinking that Buffalo couldn't do any better than a second-round pick. And not just that, the fact that they actually had to give up more compensation with Diggs in order to get that second-round pick. It is just insane. And like you said, Alex, the fact that they've also lost Gabriel Davis as well, I mean, it's almost as if we've seen the last of any sort of contending that they were going to do in this league for the time being.
Josh Allen, I mean, yeah, Mahomes. Everyone and their brother keeps, you know, yeah, he's awesome. But, like, hey, there's plenty of teams that would love Josh Allen. He is right there. He's a real Hall of Fame. I mean, an incredible quarterback, I think. So it's like, and he's not like coming off. You know, he's still in his prime too. Is this contract? Is he like a bill for life? Because I mean, they're doing him wrong right now. They're not doing a good job right now by getting rid of all of his best weapons. It's not fair to Josh Allen.
Josh Allen will be an unrestricted free agent in 2029, but he does have an opt-out in 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But, yeah, he'll be a free agent.
Is Diane still on the call?
No, she isn't, actually. I don't know what happened to her, but she disconnected.
Well, I mean, I just Bills Mafia, the crowd, the Bills fans have to be just really upset. And that's a great, great, great fan base. They're a lot of fun. They're very knowledgeable. I mean, this isn't some, you know, it's not like whatever. I'm sure there's nice Arizona fans, but it's not like the Arizona Cardinals where people have other things to do. Like, everyone and their grandmother is watching Bills fans, Bills games on a Sunday in upstate New York. I mean, they love their Bills. They have to be so pissed off right now. They're losing all their best players overnight.
No doubt they're gut-wrenching.
So what?
I mean, without a doubt, you know, Buffalo fans are really upset about this right now. I mean, you lost your best player.
Yeah. They're just gutting their roster. They're just getting rid of everyone. Josh Allen's got to be like, what am I doing? Josh Allen's looking up flight plans. Well, where are we going next? I mean, he's not going to want to stick around if they're not going to be serious about contending. These are the prime years of his career. Now, you can't blame him if he wants out.
I mean, honestly, right now they're looking at Dalton Kincaid, Curtis Samuel, and Khalil Shakir as their top three targets. Unless they use significant draft capital on a wide receiver in this year's draft.
You know, they never had to all these runs where they've been like a top four team but never made it to the Super Bowl. They never had a great running back. That's one thing they're always lacking. But
right.
Yeah. They ran into Mahomes a couple times and then they broke the band up. Everyone left.
But now you look at Houston now, they got CJ, you have you pair C.J. Stroud with Stephon Diggs, Tank Dell, and Nico Collins.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, they basically, Houston is essentially going all in for this upcoming season.
With a really good young coach and a really good young defense, too. Houston's got it all now.
Right.
They're going to be a lot better, and they're already very good, and they're very young. So they're getting better overnight, just growing. They're a really young team. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
Houston's got to be up there. Houston could easily make the AFC Championship.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me, especially with them bringing in Diggs, and who knows what they're going to do in the draft. It wouldn't be surprising at all if Houston is looked at as one of the potential front runners.
I mean, Stroud, that was his first year doing this. So he's probably going to be definitely better next year. Tank Dell, those guys, most of Houston's roster is young. They're going to be a lot better next year. Scary. And now you add a good veteran like Diggs. Wow. He's a perfect spot for them, too. That's the perfect play, the perfect addition for them. A veteran receiver for Stroud.
Yeah, it's astounding when you think about it. When you think about just exactly how much this trade completely changes the landscape of the NFL. In particular, the AFC.
I was going to suggest the Pats could have gotten him, but the Bills weren't going to trade him in the division. They're not dumb. Here you go, Patriots. They're not going to hand him over to a rival. They're like, okay, we're shipping you off to Houston. He's like, yeah.
Yeah, no, they wouldn't trade him within the division. But the Patriots did also make a move as well, as they re-signed safety Kyle Duggar to a 4-year, $58 million deal. With incentives, the deal can be worth up to $66 million, and it also includes $32.5 million fully guaranteed. This is yet again another second contract for a homegrown player. And, Kyle, you know, this is another thing, too. I remember shitting all over Kyle Duggar, the drafting of Kyle Duggar, as high as they drafted him, considering he came out of some random university, Lenoir Rhine, that nobody had ever heard of. And yet he's been putting up monster years as part of that Patriots defense. And I mean, he's a dependable playmaker in that in the back end of the Patriots defense, and he also had his healthiest season out of his entire rookie deal this year. So it's definitely Kyle Duggar. They originally had him on the transition tag, where they would have the opportunity to match any offer that was given to him. They would have the right to match that offer and bring him back. However, I guess nothing must have really been on the market for him because, I mean, he still made a major money by re-signing in New England.
Yeah, he's a key piece. It's good to see him back, and especially year one with a new coach, some new, you know, new energy in the building. It's good that he stayed there. He's got to be excited.
Yeah,
too. I'm sure almost everyone on the Patriots, even the guys who love Bill. I'm not knocking Bill Belichick, but it's fun to have a new, new leader in the building. It's fun to have a new voice, and it's a brand new day. It's going to be exciting in training camp. You know, think about the guys, Steve. I know you and Jim, you guys know the roster much better than me, but, you know it as well as I do. Like, the guys that were maybe backups last year, now they have a chance to compete to be a starter. You know, it's like there's a new energy in the building in New England.
Right, and you know, another thing too with this is there's been a lot of talk, you know, which quarterback will the Patriots take with the number 3 pick? Will they go with Drake May? Will they go with J.J. McCarthy? Could Jaden Daniels potentially fall to number 3? Which would allow them to take Jaden Daniels. I mean, there's quite a few things that have been thrown around out there. They did just have Jaden Daniels in for a top 30 visit this week, and I believe J.J. McCarthy is next week, or this upcoming week, I should say, that they'll have a top 30 visit from. So I find it very interesting that J.J. McCarthy is even in consideration for the number 3 pick.
Oh, I've been hearing it a lot this week, too, Steve. Like, I don't know. I'm not trying to jinx the guy, but I get the vibes like he's not a sure thing at all. He's not a surefire, you know, stud starting quarterback in the NFL. That's what I keep hearing. Like, it's going to be really risky. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. He's anytime you see a guy suddenly moving all the way up the draft boards like this, it's really risky. We've seen these busts happen before, especially with quarterbacks. Look at a guy like Mitch Trubisky. Or, I mean, there's countless examples. But, I mean, McCarthy, he didn't even do that much in Michigan. Harbaugh said, oh, he's the best quarterback I've ever had. The guy was, like, running the ball all day and playing awesome Michigan defense. We didn't really see a lot of – he wasn't really slinging the ball around much, you know, in Michigan. Very unknown quantity, you know, like there's a lot of question marks, I think, about McCarthy. Would you feel comfortable if the Patriots took him that high? It's tough.
I mean, here's the thing about McCarthy is that he's considered to be a game manager. And I mean, when you think of it, Brady was kind of that way, too.
Yes.
Sure.
Brady was kind of a game manager in his early years. I'm not trying to compare him to Brady. But the thing is that from what I've heard about Drake May, I've heard that, you know, he finds it very hard to read the blitz. And also something along the lines of he doesn't have much of a scramble when it comes to trying to get out of the pocket, like if the pocket collapses. That he doesn't have much of a scramble in order to get out of the pocket before he gets sacked. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, honestly, you know, the big thing about J.J. McCarthy is his college performance on him, or is it on the fact that Michigan wanted to play their offense a certain way?
Yeah. I'm not trying to knock him too much. I'm just saying, you know, he's kind of a mystery. He just, you know, he didn't get the chance to show a lot. But he hasn't shown a lot. So there's just an unknown factor.
I mean, it's worth noting, when Jim was on here, when Jim's been on here, he's made it known that what's his name is basically a 2.0 version of Mac Jones that Drake May is. So in Jim's mind, he would rather have J.J. McCarthy. I mean, obviously, he would want Jaden Daniels if Jaden Daniels somehow drops to 3. Otherwise, he would rather take J.J. McCarthy before he would take Drake May. And, I mean, when you think about it, now, granted, you know, when people think of us, national champions, you know, take a look at Stetson Bennett. You know, Stetson Bennett won, what, 2 straight titles? And he dropped all the way to like the fourth or fifth round or something to LA. So it, you know, it's just, I guess it's sort of a, it makes you wonder if it's a smoke and mirrors thing, or does New England really think that they may want to consider J.J. McCarthy?
Yeah, it gets so risky there, because if they really like Jaden Daniels, which I know you really like him, I love him too. It's like, if you can't get what you really want, do you really settle for something else just because you really want a quarterback? You don't want to draft just because of positional needs. Maybe at that point I'd take Marvin Harrison, or I'd trade down. I'd take Marvin Harrison. Even get your quarterback next
year. You know,
year.
I don't even know if they're taking Marvin Harrison, because Marvin Harrison isn't even scheduled for a top 30 visit. All their top 30 visits have been quarterbacks.
Wow. So they're really steadfast about they're looking for a quarterback or bust.
That's
no
what
pun intended.
Like.
Hopefully it better not be a bust. Yeah. I would have moved down a little, receiver, and then Penix or another guy. I don't like that whole idea of, oh, you just get a quarterback later. Like, it really is the most important position in the sport. So you don't want to just, like,
it
wait and hope someone drops.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't want to just – hopefully someone drops. Like, if someone else doesn't drop, and then you're like, okay, we'll just wait another year. It's like, now's the time. That top three, they're a third. Yeah, they're third, right?
Yeah. Third overall pick.
It's pisses. It's got to really frustrate you guys. Like, now I'm hearing the Redskins, Guardians. What's their name again? Sorry, Commanders.
The Commanders.
They're like the Commanders are like in love with Jaden Daniels now too. They had some. Did you hear about that? They had that at the combine or wherever it was, a pro day, and their staff was there,
yeah.
And people were like, "Oh yeah, you know, he's going to Commanders." It could be just a rumor, but.
Well, I heard there was smoke and mirrors. I heard there might have been smoke and mirrors as well, that they were enamored with J.J. McCarthy, too.
Yeah, and you can never trust the Commanders, Washington in general, to do the right thing. So they might screw it up. Hopefully, to me, screwing it up would be to let Daniels drop. Or I mean, would you be willing to trade your second-round pick and a future second-round pick to move up, like, one spot?
I think it really depends on what the price would be.
Yeah. Those prices just become ridiculous, though, if they know you're desperate. So it's like you got to be careful there. But
now, here's the thing with McCarthy. If they are really set on McCarthy, I would potentially look at maybe New York. Maybe look at the New York Giants and see if they would be willing to trade up. Trade down to the number six pick, get a couple of other picks in return, and then take McCarthy at six or something like that.
Yeah.
I just don't see him as a number three pick. I really don't.
No. I don't. It's just I don't like when the quarterback suddenly falls.
No.
When quarterbacks like that, when any player suddenly skyrocket up the draft, it hardly ever works out. Like, they're kind of slotted where they should be all year or for a couple of years, and then he's so risky.
Right.
And do you really want to take a real risk at like a number three pick? It's just tough.
Exactly. I mean,
it's got to be a huge chance.
Lou, let's get your thoughts on this, Lou. If you're the Patriots, where would you go with the number three pick? Would you take a Drake May? Would you take J.J. McCarthy at three? Or would you trade down and then take J.J. McCarthy? Lou?
What?
Well, what would you do? Would you take Drake May at three, or would you take J.J. McCarthy?
McCarthy.
You go with McCarthy?
Yeah. Yeah, I know you might be thinking of Philip Percy, but I think McCarthy's got a lot of, has got a lot of good mechanics, and I think he can, I think he can help the Patriots.
I mean, it's, you know, it really is surprising because there's been quite a few people who have also looked at McCarthy potentially with the number three pick. I mean, now granted, you know, it's just like I said earlier too, that McCarthy's low numbers at Michigan could potentially be just because of the system that he was in Michigan.
Yeah.
Let's see. One of the other big moves that was done over the past week or two, the Philadelphia Eagles, they have also sent they have dealt Hassan Reddick to the New York Jets. And in return, New York will send Philadelphia a conditional 2026 third-round pick. Now, that selection will become a second-rounder if Reddick plays in at least 67.5% of defensive snaps this season and records at least 10 sacks. Now...
Yeah, it was tough. Salary cap.
I mean...
Purely salary cap. He slowed down. He's also like 31 years old. But yeah, fan favorite. He's from Temple. He's from Pennsylvania. I'm not sure. Or Jersey. But like, you know, he's grew up an Eagles fan. He's a crowd favorite, but he's kind of a one-trick pony. He would, like, go after the quarterback but not play against the run. And then their whole defense disappeared last year, especially near the end. And he was basically like, I'm going to hold out or you can trade me. I want, you know, like, double my current salary. And they're, like, looking at him like, dude, you and the rest of the defense totally sucked. No one's getting a raise. And he's like, oh, okay, trade me. Okay, there you go. So it's almost like sending a message for the rest of the team. They also got Bryce Huff, who's like a really good younger player from the Jets for a lot cheaper. And you know, it helps. He's not as good as Reddick, but he's a lot younger. So they made that move
right
before they traded Reddick, before they got rid of Reddick. So that they had his replacement.
Yeah, and it does say that New York will take on $14.5 million worth of Reddick's contract, and the Eagles, meanwhile, could also be off the hook for the $1 million roster bonus, which was due to be paid out earlier in March, but was delayed to April 1st.
And also another thing, a key thing, Steve, was it helped them get Barkley, and then they Devontae Smith, the star receiver, he's due for a new contract, and so they got to have money for him. And then a big thing with Kelce retiring, they're two of their really good linemen, along with Lane Johnson's locked up, their tackle, but their left tackle, Jordan Mulata, they just re-signed him with that money, and they re-signed Landon Dickerson, who's a real stud guard from Alabama. So they're keeping that, you know what I mean? They took all that money and they're spread it out to other players. So it looks like
right.
A weird trade. It was really because of money. That otherwise they would have probably gotten more for him. So just really a salary cap move, unfortunately. So that's business.
Lou, what are your thoughts on Hassan Reddick joining the Jets? As the Jets are still trying to revamp their entire team in preparation for Aaron Rodgers' first official season. Under center.
Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah. Well, look, our problem is we can't get a good backup. You know, we tried three or four different backups this year, and it started with Zach, which was a waste, and then went downhill from there. I mean, if Rodgers gets hurt again, we have to find a strong backup to stay competitive, or else we're going to have another disastrous season like we did before. I mean, because, you know, Rodgers does not have 2 years left in him. I mean, you know, next year I think it's going to be a last year anyway. So they have to look towards the future, you know, once Rodgers is going to be gone. And we need a good second quarterback. And most of the stuff.
Yeah, but at the same time too, though, you guys are getting a defender in Reddick who has averaged, I think it's like 12 sacks per season the last 4 years.
Yes.
So, and I'll tell you right now, I do think that third round pick will convert to a second, because unless Reddick gets injured, I see him eclipsing 10 sacks again this season.
They're literally going all in. It's like bust, Super Bowl or bust, because Rodgers, I mean, they added Mike Williams from the Chargers. I think they're going to draft the awesome tight end Brock Bowers from Georgia. They have so much talent. Guys, remember, they already have a damn good defense, and now they just added Reddick, for a linebacker. So, I mean, the Jets are loaded. Like them or not, the Jets are mega talented. It literally all hinges on Rodgers. He's, like, controlling the entire team. And he's, like,
exactly.
And he's the oldest guy in the building. He's the oldest quarterback. And he's coming off an Achilles injury. Talk about risky. I mean, last year it ended in 3 plays. And now they're going all in even further. They're constructing their entire roster around Aaron Rodgers. It's nuts. There's no turning back.
Yeah. Pretty much. Elsewhere around the league, the Buffalo Bills, they signed offensive tackle Lyle Collins to a 1-year deal. Collins can earn up to $6.25 million as part of this deal. Obviously, you know, he didn't take a regular season snap last year after recovering from a torn ACL in week 16 of the 2022 season. So basically, you know, if he can get back to his old form, it should be first off, I wanted the Patriots to sign him, considering we have problems with the offensive line. But if he can get back to where he was at the top of his career, this could be a pretty good landing spot for Collins with the Bills, considering the fact that, you know, they've had to get rid of so many people this offseason, and, you know, he would be an upgrade, if anything, to their tackle position if healthy.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, speaking of the Bills, former Bills and Patriots running back Damian Harris announced his retirement from the NFL after only 5 years in the NFL, after recording 2,188 rushing yards, along with 297 receiving yards and 21 total touchdowns between the Bills and Patriots. And in my opinion, I believe his concussion that he suffered with the Bills had a little bit to do with this decision. Because it seems kind of weird that he retires after just 5 years in the league.
Yeah, it does.
You know, he's just one of those. It's like I said. I honestly think that he was, you know, the concussion that he suffered, where he had to be taken off in an ambulance, in Buffalo. I have a feeling that's partially what led to his retirement decision. Speaking of retiring, and also a former Patriot, 2-time Super Bowl champion Logan Ryan is calling it a career after 11 seasons at the age of 33. He officially announced his retirement this past Tuesday on social media. Originally selected in the third round of the 2013 NFL Draft out of Rutgers by the New England Patriots, he helped lead Bill Belichick's defense to 2 Lombardi trophies over 4 years in Foxborough, compiling 13 interceptions and 41 passes defended over the run. He then signed a big money deal with Tennessee back in 2017. His most memorable play in Tennessee came in the 2019 wild card round, where he ended Tom Brady's Patriots career by picking off Tom Brady to clinch the Titans playoff win over the Patriots that year. He then bounced around, played two seasons with the Giants before spending 2022 in Tampa with Brady. And then he joined the San Francisco 49ers late last season after the club had dealt with injuries for their playoff run. He ends his official NFL career with 19 interceptions, 98 passes defended, 15 forced fumbles, 13 sacks, and 755 total tackles.
Great career.
And also, he played in 78% of the snaps in their Super Bowl loss to Kansas City. And he also forced a fumble in one of the plays as well.
Yeah.
So, going over to Major League Baseball, and obviously it's been quite an interesting start to the season. But before we get into the updated standings, a few notes to mention. First off, Sedan Rafaela has agreed to an 8-year, $50 million extension with the Boston Red Sox. Earlier in the offseason, they signed Brian Bello to an extension. So now Sedan Rafaela is the second in a series of deals that they're hoping to make to lock up their young stars. After hitting .302 across two minor league levels last year with 20 homers and 36 steals, he has now earned an everyday role for the Red Sox in this season. And also, he has flashed Gold Glove caliber defense in center field. So if he can live up to the projections, which everybody is projecting him to be, a slightly worse Mookie Betts. And if he can live up to that, I'll say it right now, Boston fans will be more than happy with that. He doesn't have to be Mookie Betts, but if he can get anywhere close to the level of production that Mookie Betts had put up with Boston, it'll be well worth it for this contract. I mean, putting it this way, 8 years, $50 million, if he turns into a stud, would be considered a steal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're banking on him really to keep developing. He works hard, versatile, can play several positions, and he's an awesome defensive player. That's a good sign.
Yeah. And next on their list is Tristan Casas, which right now it kind of sounds like there hasn't really been much talk with Casas right now. But here's hoping that they may end up changing at some point in the future here.
Yep.
As far as Rafaela so far this season. Now, another thing to keep in mind is obviously he hasn't played a full year yet in the majors. But so far this season, he's hitting .196 with 6 RBIs and 1 stolen base. So, I mean, obviously, you know, last year he had 2 homers and 5 RBIs in the short time that he played in the majors after being called up, where he played in 28 games last year while hitting, I believe he hit .241 in the short time, the 28 games that he played last year after being called up. People have to remember, you know, he's still developing even at the age of 23. So, even though he may be up in the majors right now, I have a feeling this may be a Tristan Casas situation like it was for Casas last year, where he started off cold, and it took him getting used to how they did things in the majors to really get his stride.
Yeah, and he grew up, you know, out of the country too. I mean, talk about a tough sport to master. You're a raging success, and you're, you know, if you only fail 70% of the time, you're a 300 hitter. So, like, if this guy, he's such a good athlete, you know, he's got so much potential. Like you said, Steve, he could take a massive jump in year two or year three. He could be a lot better in 2, 3, 4 years, keep getting better and better. It's a really good sign, and I think.
Potentially.
Yeah. It's a good upside.
Now,
yeah, a good risk to take.
Now we go from good news with Boston to horrible news with Boston, as Trevor Story has officially undergone season-ending shoulder surgery after he fractured his right shoulder in a game last week, and his recovery time frame is set for 6 months, which effectively puts him out for the entire season. So now with Vaughn Grissom still on injured reserve, but he's set to come back at some point in the near future, they will have to rotate between David Hamilton, Pablo Reyes, and Romy Gonzalez at the shortstop position for the immediate future. And also, it's a possibility that they could move Zidane Rafaela to shortstop, as he did play shortstop for a little bit in the minors as well.
I would do that. Try to groom and develop Grissom and Rafaela together. That could be awesome. I didn't realize that. I know he's moved around a lot, but so he traditionally, growing up, he played mostly shortstop.
No, he played mostly in the outfield, but he did play shortstop for a little bit in the minors.
It's tough to learn on the job, though. You know, it would have been easier if it was all spring training. But
right.
How does he look when you see him play there? Does he look like it's awkward, or does he look like he could be really good?
Rafaela?
Yeah. Well, have you seen him play from short? Like, does he look decent?
I mean, honestly, there's a reason why he's been compared to Mookie Betts.
Okay.
You know, he looked just like Mookie at the shortstop position. At second base / shortstop. He looked basically just like Mookie.
So it's like he's, what, more athletic? It doesn't look I know he's an awesome center fielder, but does it look like could he be a good defensive shortstop, you think, with proper practice in, like, a year from now?
Maybe. But, you know, obviously the big thing is that Trevor Story was supposed to be the shortstop of the present and also the future with that huge contract he signed, which, by the way, it's looking worse and worse. As the years go by, because this is now the second straight season that he's going to miss with any sort of surgery. So now, I mean, it's basically this Trevor Story 6-year, $140 million contract. This is looking like the Chris Sale contract. And we remember how that went for Boston. He's basically the Chris Sale of position players for Boston right now, Trevor Story is. And it might be time for Boston to start focusing elsewhere. And I wouldn't be surprised if they shop Trevor Story in the offseason. Because he's nowhere near the player that he used to be.
That's the problem, though. So who's going to take him if he keeps breaking down with that money? They're like, no, thank you. We're good. It's too risky to take him for anyone to bring him in.
Well, and to be fair, though, this injury that he suffered, it was a freak injury. I mean, he was going for a routine dive And right as soon as he landed, he was in immediate pain. And it's weird.
Wow.
They said, like, if anything, he dislocated the shoulder, but they said that he actually at the same time fractured the shoulder socket.
Oh, it's brutal.
I mean, think about how random that is. That
yeah, he's had terrible luck.
Shoulder socket. Yeah.
I saw the play. It was like, oh, man. He was starting to play really well, too.
He was, yeah. It looked like he was going to have a comeback year. And then all of a sudden, you know, his body is basically just has just started to crumble. It was needless, like I said, it was a freak accident, basically, that nobody expected that he was gonna, you know, he was gonna injure himself the way he did, basically.
Wow.
So now they have to rely on Romy Gonzalez, David Hamilton, which I didn't know this, but David Hamilton, when he got called up last year, he was playing with a torn ligament in his thumb. That's why he was putting up subpar numbers last year.
Oh, yeah. Jeez.
And I remember telling you, Alex, last week, When this happened, I told you Hamilton is horrible. And
yeah, you warned me.
Yeah,
I was trying to be optimistic.
And yet there he goes, and he hits a homer in his first game up in a backup with Boston.
Of course.
So it's like
that works. That's like when I call
it's like, okay.
They go the opposite when I predict something like that. Oh yeah, right away it's like he heard about it. He hits the bottom.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely, I'll tell you one thing. It's this really feels, even though they're at 8-7 right now, and it's early on in the season, this feels like a lost year. I'll just say that right now. With all the injuries that they've suffered already, Pivetta is going to miss time with an injury out of the starting rotation. I mean, honestly, it really just feels like a lost year for the Boston Red Sox. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we see them become sellers at the deadline. And it's crazy to think about the trade deadline already, but, like I said, you know, it's early on in the season, and normally we can't really tell based off of early signs what exactly is going to happen. But, I mean, come on. The New York Yankees are 12-3. Baltimore is 8-6. You're 8-7, along with the Tampa Bay Rays. Toronto is 7-8. I mean, it's just... And plus you're suffering all these injuries, and at the same time you're also having that little league defense from last season to come back into the fray. It just, in all honesty,
Lou, is that you, bud? Can you mute that?
It's just not a good outlook.
Sorry, Steve.
Ultimately.
Yeah, and they started so strong too. If it goes south, yeah, they're going to be looking to sell sooner than later. They got to keep the core together, though. Rafaela, Cassis. You got to be happy about Duran, though. He looked awesome.
Yeah, Duran has started off good. Tyler O'Neill, five homers and five RBIs. The problem with O'Neill is you got to have runners on base when you're hitting those homers. I mean...
Yeah.
So I'll tell you right now, O'Neill, if he can stay healthy, you're probably looking at 30 homers from him.
Uh-huh. Definitely.
During his time with St. Louis. You know, based off of his time with St. Louis, you know, you're probably looking at 30 homers from him. Obviously, you know, health is obviously going to be a potential issue with him.
He's a physical, like, marvel. He's shorter, and the guy's, like, as muscular as anyone. He's, like, a total brick house. He hits bombs. He's a fun player to watch.
Yeah. And as far, you know, as far as some of the other players have gone, I mean, Tristan Casas, it looks like he's starting to he's starting to kind of put together a few things. You know how it took him a little while to heat up last year, but now he has 3 homers and 7 RBIs already. He's hitting .250. Right now their top 5 hitters are O'Neill, Casas, Duran, Yoshida, and Rafaela. Just based off of not necessarily based off of average, but based off of, you know, actual production. So
yeah.
It's definitely, I mean, we'll put it this way. It's definitely going to be a developmental type of season, I feel, for Boston. Plus, you do have a couple of other players, like for example, Roman Anthony, you know, one of their top prospects. He just hit 2 homers today. You have Marcelo Meyer, who just hit his first homer of the season today. Well, I mean, yesterday, actually. So it definitely feels like it's going to be more of a developmental season, I feel, for Boston, as opposed to, you know, you're not going to see them contend. And in all honesty, I think this is probably Alex Cora's last season at the helm for the Boston Red Sox. I think they'll probably move on in the off season from him.
Yeah, which is tough. They're now their younger team. And they're going to have, like you said, Roman Anthony, great outfield prospect coming up. Shortstop of the future is waiting in the minors. And their core is all young. You didn't really name any huge veterans. So it's like there's no reason why they shouldn't definitely be improved next year. All these guys are getting better with a year of experience. And then you add Grissom.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Grissom, Anthony, Mayer, you have 3 new bats coming in. So it's like, and then their pitching looked pretty good. Whitlock, Hawk got bombed. He kind of came back to reality. It comes down to the owner, unfortunately. They have good talent, though. It's kind of frustrating. It's frustrating that Cora would suddenly be leaving, you know what I mean? It's like this kind of a lost year. I'd like to see Cora with, like, this young group next year when you get, like, at least Roman Anthony. He's apparently going to be, like, a star. You add him, and, like, if Grissom's, like, a 2020 guy, you add, like, or make a trade. Make a trade with one of the outfielders, Abreu. Trade one of the outfielders for a shortstop. Then you have a whole new – you have a nice looking lineup.
Yeah, but to be fair for Hauk, it's not his fault that the team behind him is playing little league ball. I mean, they're playing little league defense, like no joke.
A pitcher is worse than me.
It's literally little league defense that we saw play in his last start.
Think how hard it is to, like, squeeze the strike zone and with the umps now and playing against really talented hitters, of course. But then if, like, you're under so much pressure on the mound, and then if you're pitching your ass off and guys are dropping little league plays behind you, mentally you're getting so pissed off, so frustrated, and then it just all explodes. Like, the guys have to play defense behind you. That's just, like, standard protocol. They have to do that. Very frustrating for Hawk.
Yeah. I mean, it's like little things. It's little things. Like, for example, you scoop the ball up, and you you toss it to second base, and the second baseman doesn't even touch the bag.
Yeah, you don't have to be Ozzie Smith. You don't have to be the Wizard of Oz to realize, you know, that's the play you should make. You should be messing up that kind of play.
Bad it's just fair. Like, or another one, for example, Rafaela in center field, he makes the catch, and then he tried to, I shouldn't say he makes the catch, because he tried to disguise it as a transfer, you know, that the ball bobbled on the transfer from hand to hand, when really he just didn't make the catch. You know, it's just these little things that it's honestly kind of embarrassing. It's like we're talking little league stuff.
Plus, I mean,
think
about it mentally,
you know,
like psychologically.
Trevor Story too.
Yeah, I was just about to say with Hawk too. He's like finally getting his chance again to be a starter. They've already messed up his mind mentally enough by yo-yoing him back and forth from the bullpen. Now he's, like, trying to pitch well and sustain some success, and he has, you know, a fourth-grade Little League team playing defense behind him. So he's like, geez,
yeah.
Can I get anything right in this? Can anything at Fenway go right for me? And he's just had the worst,
right.
Like,
and,
luck.
You know, there was...
Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, there was another thing, too, that, you know, Trevor Story, he made a diving play at shortstop, and he then, this was before the injury, he made a diving play at shortstop, and what does he do? He basically throws the ball into the dugout instead of when he was obviously aiming for first. You would think that, okay, a regular shortstop would aim for first. No, he threw it straight into the dugout.
Maybe he's pissed off at one of the bench players. He's trying to tag someone. That's awful.
I mean, it's like, what are you guys doing here? It really is pathetic. Some of the plays that they have done.
They won today, right? Yeah,
They did win. Yeah, they did win today. They won 7-2 over the Angels.
The Angels with the mighty Mr. Baseball, Anthony Rendon, leading off. What are you doing? The guy he says he hates baseball, and they're trying to start over that Otani. Why is that guy leading off? If he has to play bat, I'm like eighth or ninth. Like, I shouldn't even be in the starting lineup, but whatever. I'm not the Angels owner.
Well,
that's
since
such a weird
off,
game.
Believe it or not, since leading off, he's actually gotten his average back up to over 200 since leading off.
Okay. He's improving a little bit. Which is that's such a weird thing to do, you know? It's like, okay, brand new season, opening day, like everyone's enthusiastic. Okay, we can be legit without Otani. All right, let's look at the lineup. Oh, we have Rendon leading off. Like, talk about like setting a bad tone. It's a very strange decision to have that guy leading off your lineup. But whatever.
Today the Red Sox, they had a spot start from Cooper Criswell. Who had pitched two previous games in AAA. He couldn't go the full five innings. He only went four innings mainly because of pitch count. They were up 7-2. He couldn't make it the full five. He couldn't make it to the fifth inning because of pitch count. Gave up five runs, five hits, two earned runs. He struck out four, and honestly, the two runs were just because of a home run. So, I mean, it's a rough start for him, but I don't know if they're going to keep him up with the big squad or if this was just a spot start and he'll be sent back down. Greg Weissert picked up the win in relief, two innings of shutout ball, three strikeouts, and reducing his ERA to 1.23. Weissert was one of the guys that Boston picked up in the Alex Verdugo trade this offseason from the New York Yankees. Winkowski had two scoreless innings, and Joely Rodriguez gave everybody a heart attack in the ninth inning, but somehow managed to be able to close it.
Is it just me? I've noticed, like, having been subjected to Yankee baseball in this market, particularly, it seems kind of an annoying, like, cocky, kind of an obnoxious guy. Was he like that in Boston?
Who? Oh, Verdugo. Yes.
Or do you like him? Yeah, he's kind of like a, I don't know.
No, he's, I mean, we liked him because he brought an attitude to the team.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, he was more of a bro type of player.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a surprise that he's bringing that same attitude to New York. The only thing about him is I still can't picture him with a shaved face. I can't get that thought into my head right now. By the way, before I forget this real quick, jumping over to hockey for one quick second here, I just saw the thing on NHL on ESPN. For percentages to make the playoffs for the Eastern Conference, they have Detroit at 67% thanks to their win over Toronto today in overtime. And they have the New York Islanders at 95% to make the playoffs with Washington, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia all missing the playoffs.
Crazy.
And with Boston's 6-4 win over Pittsburgh just now, that basically closed the door on the Pittsburgh Penguins playoff hopes. But we'll talk a little bit more about hockey in just a minute here. But I want to go over the rest of the rest of Major League Baseball here. For the early season standings, we obviously covered the AL East. The Central, I think we're in the twilight zone, Alex, because the Kansas City Royals lead the Central with a 10-5 record.
They got Waka, Lugo. I know it doesn't sound like much, but they got some veteran arms, Steve, and they do have some good talent. Bobby Witt's one of the best players in the game. Never can forget about the old eternal Salvador Perez hitting bombs, hitting cleanup. Well, yeah, they have a pretty good lineup. I don't know. Well, baseball is great at doing this to us, though. You know, fooling us early. A lot of these teams will fall out by mid, you know, by the All-Star break. But right, do you think the Royals can sustain it? They if you look at their roster, they're improved. In a weak division too.
I would say, if anything, Cleveland is maybe their only threat in the Central. Because Minnesota, they didn't really do much.
Cleveland just lost their ace. Shane Bieber's down, along with Strider, too. But, yeah, I mean, Indians.
Ooh, not again.
Yeah. Plus, the Guardians, man, I root for them. But they have such a bad offense. They literally have Jose Ramirez and, like, a couple role players. Naylor. I mean, Tigers are another really young team that's, like, better, but not there yet. That's a bit. The White Sox are awful. The Twins are already, you know, losing players. The Royals might win the division.
Even though the Twins have won their last two games, the Twins didn't really do much this offseason to really improve the team. So, and Detroit is on their usual shtick of where they start off good. And then all of a sudden, within the span of like 20 games, they turn on suck mode, and they basically fall apart for the rest of the season.
Implode and just scrap by the side of the road. I mean, the Royals, it's like a battle with Detroit right now. Battle of mediocrity, the entire division. It's like a fight for 500.
Chicago, I mean, the Royals are surprised by. I'm really surprised by Chicago because they have so much talent on paper.
Robert, their center fielder. No, I hear you. The last couple of years, Eloy Jimenez is one of the best young power hitters in baseball. He's been so injured. He's already injured again. Luis Robert, their really good center fielder from Cuba, he's injured again. They're literally just, they're always injured. So it wasn't just LaRusse's fault. That was fun, though, to see that ship burn down. But, yeah, the White Sox are just,
and
like,
also they lost their, they also lost their ace in the offseason, right, if I remember correctly. Didn't they trade away their ace?
Yeah, Dylan Cease. Cease went to San Diego.
Yeah, Dylan Cease. Yeah.
So it's like they're like 2-12, 2-11. Yeah, the whole division's in shambles. I mean, the Royals might. It's weird to say they're probably as good as anyone in the division. Minnesota's probably the best, like you said, but they're kind of injured. Correa's already injured. Royce Lewis, Minnesota's really good young third baseman, is injured again. So, and Minnesota, I mean, it's literally, it's sad. Whoever gets out of the division just gets smoked in the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah.
Do you think the Royals can win that division somehow? It's just a race for a race to 80 wins, something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's different when you consider that. Okay, they're gonna have to go through the entire regular season.
Yeah.
So it's like, can they? Yeah, it's like, can they really sustain this throughout the whole regular season? That's the big question. And I'm not necessarily certain that they can.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
did Lou take off?
Lou disconnected before we went to the overtime. But,
yeah, you know who's playing better, surprisingly? The Mets, they're showing some flashes. They got beat today, but it's been fun watching them recently again. They're making it fun again. They're scoring some runs. They'll get J.D. Martinez soon. Brett Beatty, their young third baseman, is looking a lot better. So, they, you know, Nemo, Alonso, Lindor, they got some talent. We'll see if they can do it.
The Mets currently, they're 6-8. Third in the NL East behind the Atlanta Braves and the Philadelphia Phillies, which, by the way, you know, we were talking, speaking of Atlanta, you know, they're going to be without Spencer Strider for the entire season with internal brace surgery. So, I mean, it's less serious than a Tommy John surgery, but still – this will make him miss the entire 2024 season. And, I mean, this is the second major injury absence of his career, as he had Tommy John while he was still pitching at Clemson.
It's awful. He's so good, too. He's a dominant pitcher. And the Braves were our one hope to make sure that the evil empire, the Dodgers, lost. I think the Braves can still do it, but I just hate the Dodgers. I'm hoping someone knocks them off. Although I bet them tonight, they're in a rain delay. Ohtani bet along with me. I took Ohtani's bets for the night.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, wow. Yeah. Going over to Shohei Ohtani.
Las Vegas insider, Shohei Ohtani. You can sign up for a monthly newsletter to get all of his top picks, his betting picks.
I mean, wow, you know, the stuff that has come out about Ohtani's former interpreter, which, by the way, he did surrender to federal authorities yesterday. but he has been Ipe Nisuhara has been charged with bank fraud to finance a voracious appetite for illegal sports betting, and he is alleged to have transferred more than $16 million from Ohtani's account to an illegal sports book, according to Alden Gonzalez of ESPN. And, you know, honestly, what's really stunning to me is, okay, yeah, all right, you know, it's one thing to do it behind Ohtani's back, but when you take a look at some of the, you know, he made bets of, I'm trying to remember what the total was. I believe it was. He had made a total of about $180 million worth of bets. And he had, but here's the thing. He had only won back like about $130-something million worth of those bets. So, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he's already in debt for more than $16 million. And I mean, it's obviously Ohtani supposedly was unaware of any of this, you know, actually taking place. You know, whether or not we believe him is another story. But
yeah, I don't know if I got to backtrack. I was so hardcore convinced that he was guilty. I'm still leaning that way, Steve. I just don't know if it's like a sure shot right now. I don't know what to believe. Because we both agree, right? I mean, MLB is doing whatever they try to almost cover it up. They don't want him to be guilty. So it's hard for us to know if he's guilty.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's hard for us to know if he's actually guilty. When you consider exactly, you know, the fact that it's Shohei, and obviously, like you said, there is a possibility that, you know, the NHL may be trying to specifically make it so that, you know, Shohei is found to not have had anything to do whatsoever with any of these things having taken place.
It's like a regular pro player, like a Red Sox or a Patriot or an Eagle or a Milwaukee Brewer. If anyone else is caught gambling, you know what I mean? It would be a fair, like, looking at them, like, trying to find the truth. It feels like since Shohei is, like, you know, the face of baseball worldwide, they have so much money at stake. You know, they don't want anything to damage his reputation. So it's like, even if there's some proof, the MLB is not going to be in a rush to find it.
Right.
So unfortunately, we'll never really know. I just don't think he's going to get in any trouble, even if he is guilty. I'd be really surprised if he gets in any trouble. Do you think he's still going to get in any trouble, or do you think they're just going to quietly hope this goes away?
You know, I think it all really depends. I think that there is the possibility that he could be, you know, he could get into some sort of trouble, but I don't think it's going to be a case of, you know, of them actually doing something about it. I don't think, you know, what I mean is I don't think it's going to be a case of him, like, missing any sort of time, like, unless there's, you know, full on, without a shadow of a doubt, you know, that there's full on proof that he knew specifically what was going on. Which, I mean, somebody pointed this out earlier this week. How are you Shohei Ohtani and not know that how do you not notice that $16 million is taken out of your account?
It's impossible. There's no logical way you didn't know.
Right. How are you not aware that money was taken out of your account? So, I mean, it's definitely it's definitely something to consider.
For sure.
But, you know, just, it does say here that the account was set up in 2018 by Mizuhara, and he began illegal gambling back in 2021. The bets do not appear to have been made on the sport of baseball, according to what it says here. In particular, and let me scroll down a little bit here. It says, Mr. Mizuhara lied to the bank to access the account, lied to them about being Mr. Ohtani. So basically, he essentially sold himself as being Shohei to these banks. And the banks were stupid enough to believe that it was actually Shohei Ohtani. So, I mean, at this point, I don't even know if it's on him or if it's on, you know, I mean, if the obviously if the banks are that stupid, although it is technically, I mean, yeah, it is illegal, you know, it is illegal for him to have done what he did.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's only time will tell. It's just a unique situation because the people in charge like don't want him to be guilty, so he's kind of protected. So unless it's really obvious, nothing's going to happen to him.
Right. I mean, still though, it's really when you take a look at this whole ordeal, it's just really mind-boggling just looking at all this. Like, really? This is really what we're, this really went down, basically. So, it's just,
Look at the NBA player who was betting on himself, Jonte whatever Porter, the young Raptor center.
Yeah,
that guy's gonna be banned. He's gonna be banned for life, at least from the NBA.
Oh yeah, he's already. They've already informed. I forget who they informed, but somebody was already informed to report any sort of action involving him right away.
Yep. I mean, think about it. Now that it's legal, too. But, I mean, even in the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, in any sport, a quarterback would be tough. But, like, if you're a bench player, and nowadays, with the legal gambling on your phone, you can bet $1 or you can bet $1,000 on any really on any play. It's crazy. It's out of control. But so if you're a pro player now, if you have friends or the mob – or someone, drug dealers, or someone with a lot of cash gets in touch with you, they can say, look, we'll give you 50 grand. Just don't hit a shot tonight. Whatever you do, don't make a basket. And then they bet, like, you know, under 2 points or no points scored for this guy Porter. They could place bets in 20 different casinos all over the country. There could be 10 or 20 or 30 people betting on it that all know each other, like a syndicate, like a mob, like a group, making tons of money off that one player. So in turn,
right,
he could be getting paid, you know, he could be getting paid a couple briefcases full of cash just to quietly do that. So, I mean, I think through the years, it's definitely been going on. We've seen referees, you know, Tim Donaghy and the NBA got caught gambling, you know, changing the outcome of games. It's nuts. And now that it's legal, it's going to be more out of control. There's got to be more players doing it, I would think.
Yeah.
Just don't know about.
Also,
it happens in tennis.
Amongst the league,
it's definitely happened in tennis. I know that. There's been cases about that where players get busted and banned.
Yeah,
but you know, mostly overseas, smaller circuits.
I want to bring this up before I forget about it. There is an update on Julio Urias. For those who don't remember, there was a whole domestic violence thing involving him with his wife. It is reported that he has been charged with 5 misdemeanors stemming from his arrest last September. Urias, who is currently a free agent, has an arraignment scheduled for May 2nd. Major League Baseball launched its own investigation last year, which apparently remains ongoing, after Urias was arrested last September for suspicion of domestic violence. It figures to be a lengthy process, and it says here it's highly unlikely he will ever wind up pitching in the majors ever again. So imagine that. A guy throws his entire career away, basically.
Yeah. Yep. Domestic violence. Not many worse crimes if there are. So, yeah. This guy apparently he's done it a few times, too. I think several years ago he got busted as well. So Dodgers are like, no thanks. MLB, he's blackballed. He's banished himself.
Yeah, and basically threw his entire career away, essentially.
Yep.
With this. So, moving over to the NBA real quick here. Remember how we covered Drew Holiday being traded to the Boston Celtics? It has been reported that Drew Holiday has now signed an extension officially with the Boston Celtics for 4 years worth $135 million. Holiday had, and believe it or not, you know, you look at that number and you think, wow, that's a massive number. He's actually taking less money. It's funny that, you know, it's funny that I say that and you look at that number and you say, how the hell is that less money? Because he had a player option. He had a player option worth a little over $37 million for next season. And he has declined that option in order to sign this extension to play for Boston for the next 4 years. So, needless to say, any investment that Boston has made on him, he's not going to be just they're not just going to trade for him and then he's gonna jump. He's gonna leave town. He is here to stay for the long-term future. And basically the way I look at it like this. Boston sees themselves in a 4-year window.
Yeah, and I mean he's been an awesome leader. They knew what they were getting when they got him. So, I mean, it's ludicrous money. Well, welcome to the league. Welcome to all pro sports now. Even NIL, you know, it is what it is. So it's monopoly money. But, I mean, people get it in the league, and he's worth it. He's a leader. He's a point guard. He's a floor general of the team. He's an incredible defender. So he's going to be worth every penny of that contract. If he doesn't get it, someone else will get it. So he's getting what he deserves at that market rate with the way the league – with the way pro sports is. It's crazy money. But, hey, other guys in the league that are half as – talented and half as hard working as him get that contract, so he should get that money.
Right, and they're still basically they still have to work out a deal with Derek White now. Derek White is basically the last person out of that point guard room to have a new deal, as Peyton Pritchard. Prior to this season had signed a new deal for himself. So, and you've seen what he's done. Like I said last week, you know, he's been putting up elite. They say he's been putting up elite numbers off of the bench. And I mean, I'm not just talking as a Celtics fan here, but actual NBA analysts have said that he has put up elite numbers off of that bench. So
yeah, they have that killer depth now. You've been talking about it all year. We just saw it, even a team like UConn. College is different, but like, you don't have to rely on one guy. And now it's not just Tatum and Brown. Now it's not just two guys. Like they have all the pieces in place now to win it all. They have so much depth. Their bench is awesome. It's going to be crucial in the playoffs.
Yeah, the number one thing, of course, is going to be actually capitalizing while they can.
Yep.
Speaking of which, though, going over to the NBA playoff picture right now as it looks, basically with only, I believe, one game left, I'm pretty sure. There's only one game left to go, I think. The Celtics, well, they've clinched the Eastern Conference for a while now at 63-18. And, you know, you want to talk about how good the Celtics bench is. Their entire game, now granted it's against Charlotte, and they have the Washington Wizards tomorrow. They played their bench the entire game against Charlotte. All the starters took the game off, and it sounds like it's probably going to be the same thing against Washington. That the starters will get the game off against Washington in order to prevent any potential injuries from taking place. And Peyton Pritchard put up a career-high 31 in that game against Charlotte. So
he was a late first-rounder, right? I mean, I always liked him a lot coming into the draft. I was hoping the Blazers would have taken him. He's from Portland, from that area. He's always been a really good player.
Yeah, I think he was a late first-rounder. I forget, actually.
Yeah,
when they drafted him.
They have crazy depth now. They have so many good weapons. You don't have to force it. If Tatum's not in the big shots, then they won't have to worry about it. Jason Tatum's, 4-for-15 if he's really having a bad night in like a game 6 or game 7, they don't have to force feed him in the fourth quarter. You've seen how that's turned on them before, Steve. Now they don't have to do that. It's got to make Tatum deep down feel better, too. He has less pressure now. It's more of a team effort.
Yeah, and you know that's part of the goal that they've been trying to put out there for the most part this season, is that it's, you know, obviously, like, for example, Drew Holiday has had to give up he's had to give up a lot of things for this season, because of ever since he signed with Boston, we remember what he did in Milwaukee in terms of numbers, and he's only averaging like 12 points a game this year, but it's a lot more different on the surface.
He's the leader defensively, and he's unselfish. That's why he just re-signed. That's a winning player right there. There's less and less of them now. Everyone wants to score. We were talking about it before in college. Same thing in the pros. Those guys are like the championship players. Jarrell Holiday, I mean, he's an awesome player. He's not going to get pissed off if he doesn't score 20 points or 30 points, every night. He's just going to keep playing hard.
But it's definitely different when you take a look at when you consider how much a person is supposed to how much a person technically contributes.
Yeah,
when any night that Giannis Antetokounmpo was out, you could see Drew Holiday burst open for 30 some odd points, for example. So I mean, it's kind of the same thing here with, or not kind of the same thing, but now when you look at his role now in Boston, you know, it's basically like, okay, you know, now I don't nearly need to put up as much points because I'm contributing in other ways, as opposed to, you know, I'm being more of a defensive point guard and I'm more of a defensive playmaker, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he loves steals, blocks, turnovers, all that stuff. It's great.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, the
yeah,
basketball
so
players, that you know, he puts in the different stuff. He's in the trenches, blue collar. He does the stats. He does things that don't show up on a stat sheet, like the old guys used to say. You know, he's a throwback player.
Right.
He doesn't worry about scoring 30 points a night.
But now, I mean, you take a look at where the Celtics are now, and now you take a look at the Bucks as well, because you look at the Bucks, and you see the numbers that they've had, you know, ever since they've gotten rid of Holiday. I mean, yeah, they got better offensively, but how much did they pay in the long run? You know, because they did get better offensively, but yet you take a look at what has happened defensively. I mean, they're 49-32 right now in the second seed. They're tied with the New York Knicks, but because of point differential, because of the season series, they have the tiebreaker over the Knicks with the season series.
Oh yeah.
So
I think that's who they're going to play, depending on where the bracket is. But the Knicks, even without Julius Randle, man, they're playing so tough. The Celtics are definitely better. But, I mean, the Knicks won't get swept, I'll tell you that much. I think that'll go six games. Celtics will beat them, but I really, with Giannis being injured now, Steve, I mean, I think the Knicks, they're going to get the 2 seed, I'm pretty sure. And I think they're the second-best team in the East. So I don't know if that works out. Do you know if the bracket, would they match up? That would be a great series. Even, you know, Brunson, that would be awesome. He's like carrying the Knicks on his back right now. Playing as well as any player on the planet, Brunson right now. He's going through like three guys, getting triple teamed. Crazy.
Honestly, I think it all depends on I think it all depends on how it turns out for tomorrow. Because
okay.
Giannis, they did say that Giannis would miss the remainder of the regular season with a random non-contact injury that he suffered against Boston. That he would miss the rest of the regular season, but it sounded like he would be good for the playoffs, that he would be good for the start of the playoffs. But that all depends, you know, as we move ahead here, just exactly, you know, exactly what's going to happen. I'll tell you right now, the Knicks don't have to worry about the Cavaliers because the Cavaliers, they are sitting all of their starters tomorrow. So,
okay.
The Cavaliers are basically locked in the number 4 spot right now. And I would be, in all honesty, I would be surprised if the Cavaliers win tomorrow, considering that they're sitting everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, they have Darius Garland out of their entire starting five. Darius Garland is the one person who is not marked out. He's marked as doubtful. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Cavaliers lose tomorrow, and that probably will give the Knicks at least the number 3 seed confirmed, and Cavaliers will be locked in at number 4. basically what's up for grabs tomorrow is the Magic, Pacers, and Sixers are all tied for the 5th, 6th, and 7th seeds. So depending on what happens tomorrow, you know, those two teams or those three teams, I don't think you're going to be seeing them sitting their, you know, sitting their players. At least I would be surprised if they did. Considering there's still seeding on the line for those three. I think what we could potentially. And, you know, here's where things could potentially get interesting is you take a look at right now as it were to be, the Celtics would face the 8th seed, which would be whoever wins between the Bulls and the Hawks. And, like, let's say the 10 seeds remain as they are right now.
Yep.
That would mean that the battle for the 7th seed would be between the Sixers and the Miami Heat. And
interesting.
So basically whoever wins that matchup, the loser of that matchup would take on the winner of Atlanta and Chicago.
Philly's going to be dangerous, but like we were saying before, Embiid's been banged up, but they are dangerous.
Right. And also,
Atlanta's
also it's
like,
worth noting,
Trae Young is annoying.
It is worth noting, by the way, Joel Embiid did re-injure himself.
Yeah, it already happened. Wow. I didn't even see that.
So it does make you wonder if Philly is going to be a little more protective of Embiid with the season ending here. So I wouldn't be surprised if they sit out Embiid to end the season.
Yeah, that's true.
So we could very well see the play-in matchup be the Sixers against the Heat and the Bulls against the Hawks, which depending on how that goes, we could see a combination of certain matchups. But what does kind of look official right now would be the Cavaliers hosting the Orlando Magic or the Indiana Pacers or the 76ers. Once again, depending on how tomorrow's games go when it comes to the standings.
Yeah, and those teams, like you mentioned, like the Pacers, you got to respect them. Magic have had a really good year. They're finally growing up and playing well. So much young talent. But I just think at the end of the day, like Celtics-Knicks would be the best, I think, show for all the NBA fans. And I think the way the Knicks are playing right now, I think that's the way it's going to be. Do you think anyone can knock off the Celtics? Or, I mean, do you see the Knicks being, like, the closest? Do you think like the Pacers could play hard with them, or how do you see the East right now?
You know, I would not rule out the Pacers. I'll tell you right now, the Pacers have always given the Jason Tatum Celtics problems.
Yeah.
I wouldn't rule out the Magic. I'll tell you right now, the Boston looks so, you know, they look so dominant the way they are right now. I would not rule out any of the most of these teams I would not rule out in the East to potentially upset Boston. I'll tell you right now, there is one team I do not want to see Boston play in the first round, and that is Miami. I would prefer that Miami gets eliminated in the play-in tournament. it's just flashbacks from last season. I do not want to see them anywhere near Boston.
Yeah, I guess the finals last year were the plan. Anytime you have Butler and Spoelstra and Riley cooking up some things, I mean, those guys are going to play so hard. But Miami's always going to be dangerous.
Over in the Western Conference, though, boy, oh boy. Wow. Yeah, to start off with, we have a three-way tie for the first seed. The Oklahoma City Thunder currently hold possession of the number one seed at 56-25. And the number two seed right now is the Minnesota Timberwolves at 56-25. And then the number three seed is the Denver Nuggets.
Wow.
Then you have the Clippers, who are locked in at number four, it seems like. The Mavericks are locked in at number five. And right now the Pelicans, I would assume they're probably locked in at six, with the Suns, Lakers, Kings, and Warriors taking up the play-in tournament as of right now.
Wow. I'm hoping the Warriors finally just disappear. And seriously, real quick, I mean, it's Draymond Green. Whenever I haven't been watching a whole lot of NBA with MLB starting up. But, I mean, anytime I see any highlights, Draymond Green's chasing a referee or elbowing someone or faking an injury and falling under the hoop after grappling with someone. That guy is more out of control than ever.
I know.
Will he ever get reprimanded? Like, they're like, okay, go see a therapist. Oh, I saw someone for 8 minutes. I'm rehabilitated. I'm good again. I mean, what a joke. He's, like, so protected by the NBA. He can do whatever he wants. What a mockery.
I know. It really is a joke. It really is a joke, to be honest.
Why is he so protected? It's like, gee, I've never seen a player in any sport where you can literally get away with murder and not get penalized. Does he have some, like, dirt on Commissioner Silver? Does he have, like, some incriminating photos of him? I mean, what is the deal here? He's like, Draymond Green's like protected.
You know, I wish I knew.
He's like mafia boss or something. It's so absurd. So bizarre. Just inexcusable.
Yeah, in all honesty, I wish I knew what was up with him.
I've never seen this with anyone. He gets like, you know, maybe like Jordan or Kobe getting some calls. I understand that. But this guy literally like beats people up on the court and doesn't get penalized, and he's just like a role player. I've never seen anything like it in any sport.
Right, but yeah, it's for some reason they're the beloved child of the NBA right now, and they have been for the last however many years.
They just don't want to see them fade away. I
guess not.
The Lakers and Warriors, are they in the same play-in, or are they trying to orchestrate so both will get in, just so I can really be pissed off? Can at least
well,
one of them not
Suns,
just go away?
It's going to be the Suns and the Lakers for the seventh seed, and then the loser of that matchup will take on the winner of the Kings and Warriors. So
I don't – on my deathbed, I still won't know how the play-in really works. But thank you for clarifying it for now. I'm so confused by the whole format. I just know the Lakers and Warriors, seemingly, they always get like a play-in chance. They're never quite done.
Right.
I mean, if they don't win, Silver will be like, you know what, we're going to actually extend it like a play-in weekend. We'll go a couple more games for these guys. Draymond Green will convince them to like extend the season for them.
It does kind of piss me off, quite frankly.
They're always in the play-in. The Lakers are, and now the Warriors are joining them. Like they're just not quite done yet, so we're going to get them in the play-ins until they all retire. God.
Yeah.
Hey, Bay. What can I do? Nothing.
Yeah. Moving over to the NHL, we have, of course, you see, this is what the interesting part of the year, because not only are the NBA playoffs starting up, but so are the Stanley Cup playoffs. And with two games to go on the season, and in some cases one game to go, we currently have quite a race for the top of the Atlantic Division. The Boston Bruins, with two games on hand, they take a slim one-point lead over the Florida Panthers for the Atlantic Division crown. Florida has one game left to go. Boston has two games left. So depending on what happens, if Florida loses that final game, Boston may not even need to play any of their players, or not play any of their players, but for that final game, they may not have to, you know, they could potentially sit a couple of players and, you know, make sure players are healthy for the start of the playoffs. But as it appears right now, it looks as if Boston and Boston and Florida have locked up the top two seeds in the East, or in the Atlantic Division, due to Toronto's overtime loss today. And obviously, with only two games to go, Toronto can only make up 4 points, which will not catch either Boston or Florida. So Toronto is officially locked in the number three seed. And actually, yeah, with Tampa only having two games left too, Tampa, they are locked in as the wild card, as one of the wild cards. In the Metropolitan Division, you have the New York Rangers actually leading the Eastern Conference with 112 points. So that is still technically up for grabs, depending on what happens with the Rangers' final game. The Carolina Hurricanes, they have also locked up a playoff spot at 109 points. They are currently locked in right now as the number two seed of the Metropolitan Division. And one seed that is still up for grabs is the number three seed. It looks like the New York Islanders, two games left, currently at 90 points. They currently sit in that final guaranteed spot. Not sure, though, if they will hold on to that, but it is a possibility. So that is something to keep in mind moving forward here, specifically for them.
They got a good fan base. They've had a good tradition. It's kind of cool to see them, you know, getting back in, making a late push like this.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also one more wild card up for grabs as well. The Washington Capitals, Detroit Red Wings, and Philadelphia Flyers are all tied with 87 points. And Pittsburgh, still at 86 with their 6-4 loss to Boston tonight. But they have two games remaining, so the window is still open for Pittsburgh. But I would say they're kind of on the out a little bit when it comes to that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too confident in them potentially winning their way into the playoffs. So it is still possible.
Steve, I know you and Lou, you guys are great, great, great hockey fans. I'm definitely building my passion back up thanks to you guys. Do you have more insight? Do you ever sense where there's sort of almost favoritism, where the league would love certain teams to get certain calls? If you know what I mean, like the Lakers, where they're kind of like close calls, kind of go to the Warriors, or maybe the Chiefs. Sometimes Mahomes gets an extra penalty, you know, called for him. Does it happen like that at all?
Is it
pretty fair all around?
I mean, usually it's fair. There are certain occasions where you'll see missed calls. And mostly, for the most part, it's usually on the referees. You know, it's not like it's basically at the referee's discretion. You know, the referees don't get told by the league, oh, here, we want this team to win, so, you know, we would prefer this type of matchup, yada, yada. I would say, you know, there is maybe a little bit of that in the league, but it's far less compared to, say, the NBA or the NFL. It's far less than
gotcha.
That.
But
I not you know I get exactly what you're talking about though.
I sound like I'm crying over spilled milk, but it's always pissed me off. You know, through the years when you're watching a team just get like jobbed because they're a smaller market or because they're not like, you know what I mean? It's happened so much with the Lakers.
Oh yeah,
I kind of pick on them. Or the Warriors
now.
They used to be the Lakers.
Yeah, you don't. I would say you don't really see that when it comes to the NHL.
Gotcha.
For the most part. I mean, there is the possibility that it could. Just take a look at it now. Sidney Crosby, you know, he was the golden child of the NHL for quite a bit. And
that's actually what caused me to ask that question, because I was thinking, oh, I'm sure the league would want Sidney in. And I'm thinking, wait a second, I don't normally read or hear about that, where it's like, oh, they got in again. They got the lucky call again. It doesn't seem like it happens that much.
No, put it this way. They're in the same position right now that they were in last year. They missed the playoffs just barely last year. You know, I would say that there is a case to be made for maybe a little bit of favoritism in terms of, okay, would certain players get called more for certain, you know, a lot of it has to do with, okay, does this player have a history? Like, is this player historically a dirty player?
Gotcha.
You know, there's certain things that come into play with certain situations.
Sure.
But for the most part, it's you know, all in all, for the most part, it's considered to be more of a fair type of league where they let the players do the talking for the most part.
The way it should be. It's good.
Yeah.
I love the other leagues, but yeah, I hate when a random sign of favoritism surfaces. I mean, I love all those leagues a lot, but it's cool that hockey is even more pure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's always been that way, honestly. It's always been that way. Over in the Western Conference, we have the Dallas Stars starting with the Central Division. The Dallas Stars, for the first time in seemingly forever, have locked up the Central Division after holding the lead, I believe, for 72 days it was, or something like that. They have locked up the Central Division title. With 111 points. The Winnipeg Jets, they have locked up a playoff spot. They are currently in the second seed at 106 points. And the Colorado Avalanche are currently in the third seed. They have locked up a playoff spot at 104 points. In the Pacific Division, the Vancouver Canucks, they have locked up a playoff spot, but the Pacific Division is still up for grabs. Currently, they are sitting at 105 points, 3 points ahead of second-place Edmonton. And the LA Kings, they're out of the divisional aspect of it, but they are locked up officially with 95 points in the number three spot. And as far as the wild card goes, the Nashville Predators, they have locked up their spot with 99 points as the first wild card, and the Vegas Golden Knights, they have officially locked up their opportunity to defend their Stanley Cup with 94 points. So it's going to be very interesting this playoff run here to see exactly who may potentially get it. And, you know, in particular, I'll say right now, I'm very impressed by Nashville. Everybody was looking at Nashville as a potential long-term rebuild. And from the looks of it, it looks like that's not going to be the case. You know, Nashville, they have a lot of draft picks to play with. And from the looks of things, it looks like they're going to they have the potential to make some noise in these playoffs with how they've played this year.
Hey, as long as you get in, anything's possible. Just get in.
Exactly. I mean, anything is possible as long as you get in. I mean, hell, we saw that happen with the Vegas Golden Knights in their first year, or their first or second year, where they made it to the Stanley Cup Finals. And granted, they ended up losing in the finals, but still, the fact is that they actually made it to the Cup Finals within their first 2 years in the league, which normally for an expansion team, you don't see that happen.
That's a really cool fact. I mean, that's just tough to top in any sport. They're like brand new and they go all the way to the top.
It's worth noting too that with the players they acquired at the deadline, and you consider the players they've had on injured reserve, they are about to get those players back off of injured reserve. So it's gonna be They're going to be getting a lot more healthier as we head into the playoffs here. And speaking of the Vegas Golden Knights, they locked up one of those players, in particular, Noah Hanifin, who they acquired at the deadline. And by the way, Mark Stone, their captain, has been cleared to return to practice. But the Vegas Golden Knights, they signed Noah Hanifin to an 8-year extension with a cap hit of $7.35 million, including a 6-year full no trade clause and full signing bonuses as well. So
wow.
Their core is basically locked up long term for the future here out in Vegas. Now their next thing they're going to have to do is find a way to sign Jonathan Audi Marchessault, who was the Conn Smythe winner last year in the Stanley Cup Finals for the Stanley Cup MVP, basically. So that'll be interesting to see how they can make that happen. Also, before I forget, the Arizona Coyotes, they have a new home as they will be relocating to Salt Lake City, Utah. And an official announcement could be made on April 17th, it says here.
Oh, sorry, Steve. I was just going to quickly say, I think you'd already stepped off Lou's show, but I mentioned it in his show. Like, yeah, nothing against Utah, but, I mean, Seattle's a city. Since they lost the Sonics, I mean, look at how passionate they are about the Seahawks and the Mariners. I was thinking they might get a hockey team. I'm a little surprised by Utah.
They do.
What do I know?
No, they do. They have a hockey team. The Kraken.
Oh, you're right. Jeez. Oh, my God. I'm surprised no one called me out on Lou's show. I totally forgot about the Kraken. Wow, it's awful. It's my blonde moment of the day. I just hit my quota. Finally, just before midnight. Oh, I totally forgot. Do you think Utah makes some sense? Like, it just doesn't seem like a, you know, hockey destination to me.
Yeah, but, I mean, they already have a ready-made, you know, they already have a ready-made arena, you know, where the Utah Jazz play.
Oh, that's a good call.
And if I remember correctly, I believe, let me check, they used to have a AHL team called the Utah Grizzlies.
Oh, okay. Wow, I really dropped the ball on it. I totally forgot about the Kraken.
So, I mean, the Utah Grizzlies right now, they play in the ECHL, so I don't know if they're going to play in where the Utah Jazz play or if they're going to play where the Grizzlies play. But I'll tell you right now, considering the fact that Arizona has been playing in a college arena the last two years, they're going to get a lot more support out in Utah, I feel, than they did out in Arizona.
I don't doubt it then, yeah.
I mean, it's
a good call. I wasn't sure about
enough.
That.
I mean, it's bad enough to the fact that they're not even able to get an arena for themselves. You know?
Wow. Yeah, they deserve better.
It's bad enough that they won't get an arena made for themselves. So, you know, now that's why this movement is happening.
Is that immediate?
Because,
is that next year, right away?
Hang on. Let me read this correctly. I'm trying to see where the... I want to say yes. Let me see.
It's the Coyotes
players were informed today, meaning yesterday, that the relocation to Salt Lake City is indeed happening. So I'm going to take a guess and say that, yeah, it would probably happen right away.
Gotcha. Yeah, I would think so, since they have the arena already in place.
Yeah, it's hard to tell though. It's hard to tell though. Just based off of the reading of this, the article isn't really giving much in terms of, you know, is this happening right away? Is it going to take one more year? Or what exactly is going to happen? But yeah, it's definitely. I'll stick by what I said. I think they'll receive a lot more support in Utah as opposed to if they were going to stay in Arizona.
Yeah, and good for them. Hopefully the crowd really enjoys it.
Yeah. But that's going to wrap it up for tonight's show. We will be back next Saturday night, depending on if Blog Talk has problems or not. We will be back next Saturday night for another edition of Sports Whispers Weekly. For any Survivor fans, a reminder to tune in this upcoming Thursday night for another edition of the Survivor 46 Recap Podcast. So we'll be back next Saturday night for another edition of Sports Whispers Weekly. Thank you to Alex, Lou, and Diane for joining me tonight. And everybody have a great rest of your weekend, and we will see you guys next Saturday night.